Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
All right, your Ben Jarofsky Show for Wednesday, October 13th. It's just moments away. But before we do this, let's thank our sponsors. Sponsors like SEIU Healthcare, Illinois, Indiana. The Chicago Federation of Labor are sponsors. The Chicago Teachers Union. It's true. They're sponsors. And Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for all things there is to know the city of Chicago. Where to go. What to do, what to eat, what to drink, what kind of pot to smoke, drink, and eat, or whatever, and so much more. Chicago Reader, ChicagoReader.com. Subscribe. Check out Ben's weekly column at the Chicago Reader. And if you want to help out this program, you can. ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky, and you can be a Benhead. That's ChicagoReader.com/JORA. V as in victory. SKY. It is Wednesday, October 13th, and live from my apartment and his Airbnb in Los Angeles, California, this is the Ben Jarofsky Show. Today on the program, legendary Chicago journalist Monroe Anderson and the long-awaited return of Tracy Bame of the Chicago Reader. And now your host, rumor has it he bought a surfboard. He's really liking California. Chicago Reader columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Hello, everybody. That's hilarious. Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here.
Hang ten. Cowabunga.
I do. I do enjoy watching guys surfing. It's true. The notion of me in a surfboard is so preposterous that I'm laughing. And they got these like mini surfboards. You've seen those, D? What do they call those? You know, boogie board?
Boogie board, I believe. Yeah.
Oh, my God. There was a guy doing a boogie board the other day. You know, I was in Malibu, man, hanging out in Malibu. Did I tell you I was at Malibu? And he's on his boogie board. I was so jealous. Monroe Anderson is joining us. I love it when Monroe Anderson shows up. Monroe Anderson, by the way, very good on a surfboard and a boogie board. He's a California guy. He's on hanging out. But wait a minute. You made me laugh, D. I went on a tangent. I just want to say today's show, happy anniversary, reader.
All right. Yeah.
That's the like the little sounds, the party sounds, horn sound.
Sorry. Couldn't hear it over the sounds of Monroe watching TV and it being on the show.
Always my favorite part of the show where Monroe comes on and he's got MSNBC on. So it's the Reader's 50th anniversary, and Tracy Bame will be coming on the show, Reader publisher, co-publisher, I should say, Tracy Bame, an old friend of Monroe's, will be on the show later. We'll be talking a lot of Reader stuff and Harold Washington stuff. We're all feeling the vibe from the 70s and the 80s. And we were all there, Tracy Monroe and myself. So we'll have a lot to talk about in the future of journalism, et cetera, and so forth. And what's that?
Speaking of historical figures, Tim Black died today.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I did not know Tim Black, legendary civil rights activist, teacher, and historian, brilliant man.
Right. 102.
Wow, 102 years old. God bless you, Tim Black. Tim Black, man. He started off as a high school English teacher, I want to say, at Hyde Park Academy, or was Hyde Park High School back in the day. a long time ago. Wow, I did not know that. So I saw that he was.
It's new. Yeah. I mean, it's today he died.
Yeah. As in breaking news. So anyway, my condolences to the Timberlake's family. What a great Chicagoan. I have to say this before I get to Monroe, you'll appreciate this. This is Frank out there in listener land. I was wondering what it was that you sent me that I had to talk about. Now I remembered the Jeb Bush guacamole bowl. And Monroe, yes, Jeb Bush and his wife have their own guacamole bowl, which they are selling on the internet for $75. So you can buy one yourself. And I'm like, I don't know. The Bushes should just go away. You know what I'm saying? No one likes the Bushes.
They hadn't gone away. I thought they were gone already.
It's easy to think that, but I mean, just this was so preposterous that they're peddling their bowl, and I guess everybody's trying to sell something. $75 for a Jeb Bush guacamole bowl. I'm not sure why anybody would pay a nickel for anything for Jeb Bush.
Speaking of politicians going away, now you know Bill Clinton had a best-selling novel. With a famous writer.
Yeah, James Patterson.
Yeah, right. And now Hillary has a book, a novel coming out with one of these best-selling writers. Her name is something Penny.
Yeah, Louise Penny. Yes. Yes.
So maybe we ought to write a novel together, Ben.
Yeah. Let me just tell you something. As perhaps... one of the few people in the universe who's actually read portions. I cannot claim to have read the entire Bill Clinton. The first one that came out was utterly dreadful. And
The novel? So,
yes, Clinton novel. First of all, memoirs by ex-presidents are pretty dreadful.
Right.
I'm just telling you that right now. They rewrite history. They edit out the good stuff. They make themselves look super great. They try to twist and turn all the negativity, Monroe, into positive things. I've read through Richard Nixon's, Bill Clinton's, Barack Obama. Who else? I could not bear George Bush's. He wrote one too, believe it or not. And I think Gerald Ford wrote one as well, which I didn't read. I've read some of Jimmy Carter's, but Bill Clinton's novels are horrible, absolutely horrible. And I read, you'll get a kick out of this, I read a review about Hillary's novel. And unlike Bill doesn't get quote unquote political. He doesn't use the novel to settle scores necessarily. According to the article I read, Hillary Clinton goes after a certain Donald John Trump.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, if he dies before she does, she will sneak in the graveyard and piss on his grave before it's over.
Well, to a large degree, she has her husband. I know we weren't going to talk about this, but she has her husband to blame for the debacle of losing to Donald Trump in 2016, even though, as I like to point out, she actually won the election. She got more votes than Donald Trump. We have an insane system of picking presidents. I always want to say that. That's a very important point that I always want to make. She effectively won and lost. Very interesting system we have. If we did that system, as I like to point out, Monroe, in football, the Oakland Raiders would have been victorious on Sunday because they scored less points than the Bears. So if we'd had the same system for football.
If we had that system, the Sox would still be in the playoffs.
Yes, the Sox would be advancing to play the Boston Red Sox. Actually, they would be advancing to play the Tampa Bay Rays because Tampa Bay would have won by losing. So, yes, very strange system we have. But we'll save the Clinton talk for another time. Clintons are on my mind a lot these days because I've been watching impeachment on the impeachment show on Hulu. All right, Monroe, let's talk about a combination of race, politics, and football. It's something I'm really eager to talk about because I find it so profoundly disturbing on many levels. And we already had a little talk about this before the show, and you said, "Why are you surprised?"
Right.
And what can I say? John Gruden, the former coach of the Oakland Raiders. John Gruden, the former TV personality on Monday Night Football. John Gruden, a fabulously wealthy white man who's benefited from his contacts with football to become fabulously wealthy and successful, had to step down. I don't know if my listeners follow sports in any way, but I'll just give this little summary. He had to step down after the New York Times uncovered scores of emails that he had written over the years, Monroe, from approximately 2011 to 2018, to a friend of his who was a high-ranking official with the Washington football team, a team that used to be known as the Redskins. I'm not making this up, folks. This is football in America. And they in those emails, John Gruden ranted and railed against black people, gays, women. Am I leaving anybody out, Monroe? I think that pretty much covers.
Let's see. Black women, gays. I think that covers
it. That covers anyone. He showed him to be himself to be a total ass, a bigot, a racist, a homophobe. And this was the secret side. A what?
A misogynist.
This is the secret side of a very public man. At the time he was writing these emails, he was one of the most popular personalities on TV because he was a color commentator on Monday Night Football. And so it's just so disturbing on so many levels to me, Monroe, that he could like be allowed to slip through life with this like double life. The public John Gruden, who's bringing in millions of dollars, and he made millions, Monroe, millions of dollars. And then the secret John Gruden, who's a freaking racist. Right. Your thoughts?
Well, he said he wasn't, just for the record. He said he was not a racist. I guess his thinking was that he didn't particularly mind niggers. But sometimes he has something not nice to say about us.
Well, let me just explain where he said he was not a racist. The way this story developed, the first article to break about John Gruden's secret email was in the Wall Street Journal about a week ago, and it was just one email.
Yeah.
So the NFL has been doing an investigation of the Washington Redskins. That was their old name, Washington Redskins, the Washington football team. And
who the owner fought long and hard to keep the name Redskins. Although every Native American in the United States said it was offensive to them. It would be like if it was the Washington Colors or something.
Absolutely, yeah. Daniel Snyder dug in his heels on that one. Very bizarre fight that he was having there. I almost, in some levels, he was more at least open about his bigotry,
right?
Than John Gruden. So in a weird way, it's almost, I don't know.
Now the difference is Gruden needed the approval of the powers that be to do his show, whereas the owner of the Washington Redskins had the money and didn't have to listen to anybody and didn't have to worry about it. People are going to go watch his game, his team play, whether they liked it or not. Except time finally caught up with him, where he was forced to change, because we are in changing times.
Well, we'll talk about how much changing times we are in a little bit, because this all connects to Trump and the politics, as you pointed out when we were chatting before the show.
Yeah.
So anyway, just one more time. So the Wall Street Journal uncovered. So there's this investigation by the National Football League into the work environment of the Washington football team. And as a result of that investigation, they got access, the NFL investigators, the National Football League investors, got access to over 600,000, Monroe, 600,000. 5,000 internal email of Washington Redskins employees. And in those emails, they discovered the messages that John Gruden, who did not work for the Washington Redskins, but was friends with one of the chief officers for the Washington Redskins, had sent to his friend, Allen. That's his friend's name. So Gruden, they found Gruden's emails in that batch of emails that had gone to the head of the Washington Redskins. And in one of those emails, he made some very disparaging remarks about DeMarcus Smith, who is the head of the Players Association. He made some racial slurs regarding his lips.
Yeah.
And that was the email that was presented, that was unveiled, I think, on Friday or Thursday of last week, just before the Raiders played the Bears. And that's where Gruden got up and he said, "I don't have a racist bone in my body," which is such a bizarre thing to say. Like, what is a racist bone? You know what I'm saying, Monroe? Yeah. What is a racist bone?
It's a cliche. That's what it is.
So that he said that they played the game. Their team was really flat. The Bears beat them, which is
the black quarterback kicked their butt.
Yep. That's correct. Justin Fields of the Bears kicked their butt. And then the next day, the New York Times somehow or other got access to a whole bunch of other emails that were not originally reported, in which he made slurs against gays and women and more racial slurs, took a hard shot at players who had Eric Reed, who had taken the knee, you know, made disparaging remarks about protesting football players, and really exposed himself at greater length. And that was so embarrassing to football that he was forced to step down. So I don't know if he's still clinging to that "not a racist bone in my body" line that he was using from last week, since all these new emails have come out. Do you understand? He may want to update. "Well, I suddenly discovered a racist femur that I did not know existed."
No, I think he's sticking with he's not a racist. I think these modern day racists have been moved closer to the modern years, this century, to not be proud of being a racist. You know, back in the Wallace days, they brag about it. "Yeah, I'm a racist. I don't want to do this." Now those who are in power or in the public arena weren't comfortable with doing that until enter Donald Trump. But that's another story. We'll get to Trump.
I have to ask you a question.
Yes.
Monroe is our resident expert on white people, having lived and worked among them his entire life.
No, well, not my entire professional life. I grew
that's
up
correct.
In segregated Gary,
yes.
A segregated community. I didn't know a white person socially until I went to Indiana University.
That is correct. I said corrected. His entire adult life, I would say. Yeah. So having lived among them and worked with them for his entire adult life, you've learned a thing or two
and about studied white people. I'm the Jane Goodall of white people.
He studied them in their natural habitat.
Exactly.
See, white people at the Tribune, you didn't know Monroe was watching you when you were walking around. He was observing and taking notes and studying you. So having observed white people for all these years, Monroe, it's been a few years since you were a kid in segregated Gary, Indiana.
Yeah.
Having never met a white person.
Right.
When in your humble opinion.
Yes.
When John Gruden says, quote, "There's not a racist bone in my body," knowing that he's written all these emails that are racist, do you think in his mind he believes what he says, that he's not racist, that somehow or other you can write racist emails and not be racist? Monroe Anderson, having studied the white person for all these years, Your thoughts on this?
Yes, I think he really thinks that he's not a racist. You know, because the goals have moved. If you aren't saying nigger every other word, and you don't care if they sit on the front at the front of the bus or not, it's okay if they're in the same restaurant. Maybe you don't want them at the next table, but if they're in the same restaurant, that's okay with you. Then you think that you are progressive. And you don't think that you don't think that you're a racist. He probably has a black friend or two along the Allen West line or something, and so he has somebody to sort of validate him. He'll say something racist, and that person won't say anything, or might not in agreement with what he said. So. I'm sure he doesn't think he's a racist, but you know, I'm sure Ditka doesn't think he's a racist either. But Richard Denton, if we're not back in the 80s, told me that Ditka had a lot of red on his neck.
Ditka, of course, being Mike Ditka, MAGA Mike, as I like to call him, right, coach exactly. of the Chicago Bears, who is MAGA long before it was fashionable. And this gets into one of my pet peeves about the NFL, which I write about from time to time. The amount of, how do I put it, casual bigotry that's displayed over the years on a regular basis by people like Ditka, what's the other guy's name? Hank Williams III, who is the he's a country western singer whose song led off Monday Night Football, it was tolerated. Rush Limbaugh for a while. I don't know if you remember this, was brought on by I think it was CBS to be a panelist on their Sunday NFL show. And then he finally had to step down after Rush Limbaugh was wrestling. Do you remember this, Monroe? Where he was talking about, the quarterback for the Philadelphia Eagles, whose name is escaping me now. He comes from Chicago, a black man. And he said that white reporters won't criticize him, even though they should, because they're afraid of being called racist. So he was like, the argument was that this guy was getting a pass, which is such a freaking ludicrous argument to make. Like anybody... quarterbacks are just utterly upset, you know, analyzed Monroe after every game. You know what I'm saying? There's the notion that someone's getting a pass is ridiculous. I've never seen it happen anywhere. So it just seems like there's so much casual bigotry. Hold on, Monroe. I think we've lost your sound. Dennis, is Monroe sound?
You're on mute, Monroe. Unmute that sucker. There you go.
I forgot. I turned it. Okay. Sorry about that. I can remember when white sportscasters used to make the difference between white players and black players, where when a white player did something, it was a very intelligent thing they did. When a black player did it, well, he had this intuitive talent, this natural talent doing it. It wasn't because he thought about it or figured it out. It was because he was just born that way, a natural talent. And of course, therefore, none of them could be quarterbacks.
Yeah, they weren't smart enough.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And who was that guy who got fired because he said that if they let blacks do much more in football, there wouldn't be anything for them to do. White men to do.
Oh yeah. Well, that's now you're heading into Ben theory country, which I kind of share with a certain wife of yours, Joyce Owens. Now you're heading into our theory, which is I think I'll keep the Ben Joyce theory to the side for the moment.
Right, exactly. Right.
Don't want to embarrass Ben or Joyce, right. But we subscribe to the same theory. Yeah. Right. I remember. You have to. Blacks will completely take over everything.
Exactly. I think he's Italian.
Very bizarre situation, Monroe, in the NFL. And then you mentioned this earlier when we were talking about it. And it's I want you to go into it a little bit, where you black, most of the players, I think 70% of the players are
70%,
black.
Yeah, 70% of the players are black, getting their brains knocked out, risking getting the football player's version of dementia later on in life, making these owners, these white owners, most of whom, not all, but most of whom, own teams just as a like toy, like they'd have a race cars or a Model T or whatever. They have a football team that gives them something to do, and they are a private club. If Dennis, you and me put all our money together and tried to buy an NFL team, they wouldn't sell it to us.
What a thought, you, me, and Dennis owning an NFL team. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, it's a private club, and they have these very disparaging attitudes about the players. And so going back to one of my pet peeves for years.
Yeah, because let me make one other point, Ben. They, unlike the NFL, the NBA, which has a strong union, and they too have a bunch of black men making the money, but careers last much longer in the NBA than it does in the NFL. The average player, I think, lasts 5 years in the NFL, if they're lucky. So the players don't have, and there's more of them, so the players don't have the influence among the owners in the NFL that the players in the NBA have. And that does make a difference.
Yeah, and then the other thing, to your point, is that contracts in the NBA are guaranteed against injury, whereas in the NFL, a good chunk of a player's contract is non-guaranteed. So there's the money that's guaranteed, and then there's the rest of the contract, which isn't guaranteed. Yeah. So a player can be dropped at any moment.
Right.
And they are.
Yes. Now they have a whole... they have a whole new breed, a new batch of players that are just coming out of college who are superstars in college. And so they have an unending supply of talent at this point.
And that's why, Monroe, going back to Ditka, I thought about this, and I put this in a Reader column once. I don't know if I ever shared this with you, but Ditka would say the most outrageous things all the time, right-wing rhetoric, while he was coach of the Bears, and he had, and even afterwards when he was a media personality and beloved in the city of Chicago, the coach, right?
Right.
He would say outrageous stuff. I remember when Carol Moseley Braun was running for Senate back in the early 90s, Ditka endorsed Rich Williamson, who was running against her.
Yeah.
And he was so disparaging in his remarks about Carol Moseley Braun. And he was so disparaging about in his remarks about Clinton, Bill Clinton, who was running for president. And he said, like, it would be the worst thing that could happen to our country if Clinton were elected or Carol Moseley Braun was elected. I can't remember the exact thing. And I'm like thinking, what? Like worse than slavery? Worse than, the Civil War? Worse than Pearl Harbor? I mean, it's ridiculous rhetoric. And I was like, what if you were a black player on the Bears?
Right.
And this was your coach, and he's saying this nonsense. And then you have to go into, to Hallis Hall and pretend that you really admire him. And
or do whatever he tells you to do. And knowing what he really is like. I've been in that movie before.
What's that?
Said I've been in that movie before.
What with having to deal with
having some boss, a white boss, who I knew was racist, and having to work for them, and suffer the consequences.
Did you ever?
I had a general manager when I was at Channel 2, who was from Mississippi, and we would meet and talk about things. And sometimes he like one time he said, at Richmond, I think it was Richmond. And then he says, you know where the president is buried? And he's talking about Lee.
You're kidding. He said this to you?
Yes. With just the two of us in the room.
So how did you respond?
I ignored it. What could I do? Actually, the way I got back at him was he had two sons. One was a Minneapolis policeman. The other was in the had just joined the Army. And so I said to him, I said, what did you do to your sons to make them get such dangerous jobs?
And his response?
Nothing.
Nothing. By the way, Tracy Baim from the Chicago Reader has joined us, publisher, co-publisher, I should say, of the Chicago Reader. Tracy, welcome to the show. And we have a lot of reader talk ahead of us because it's the 50th anniversary of the Reader. And Monroe, Tracy's here. I'm also going to get some media observations out of her as well. But before we completely leave this topic, Monroe,
yes,
and maybe Tracy has something to add to this as well. Tracy, we've been talking about John Gruden, the former coach of the Oakland Raiders, who had to step down after the New York Times revealed dozens of emails that were misogynist, homophobic, racist, you name it. And somehow or other, he had two lives, Tracy. He was able to have a very high-profile existence on national TV while he was writing these emails. And then he was like this private life. I don't know how many people he shared his thoughts, his real thoughts with, and it caught up to him. Monroe, you said before we began the show that you see a correlation between the John Gruden and his emails and the attitudes that he expressed in them and the elevation of Donald Trump in the Republican Party. And what is that correlation?
Too large a proportion of white America is racist. And we have progressed enough where they aren't bragging about it now. And they try to disguise it, some of them. But they're still racist. They're still a white supremacist mentality.
Well, I'd be curious to see if MAGA comes to John Gruden's defense, as they do so often, talking about his rights to free expression and his liberty. We'll be very curious to see Monroe if they make him.
MAGA in this case would be Fox TV.
Yes, would be Fox. So
yeah, so we'll see if
we'll see. Your job for the next week is to watch Fox. I don't have to watch it, and then you can report back to me later on. Tracy Baim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm gonna. I can't wait for all the other email dumps because there were other people on the other end of those emails that likely responded right back to him. So there's going to be an endless, I hope, release of emails that are far more interesting than the alleged email scandals of Hillary Clinton, which were about usually ordering lunch and who to invite to events. Like, who cares?
Right.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Tracy. I didn't make that earlier on, that we've only so far seen John Gruden's emails. We've not seen the response that he got. So we don't know, for instance, when he made his remarks about Michael Sam's, the first openly gay player in the National Football League, calling him a queer and say, why would you draft someone like that? We don't know what the other person wrote back.
Right.
And that other person was at the time would have been a high ranking official with the Washington football team. So you're right.
Right.
And, you know, Tracy, they haven't revealed. The New York Times obviously will not reveal its sources. So they've not revealed how they got the emails. But to your point, if they got John Gruden's emails, they probably are can get you Allen's emails. That's the name of the guy, Allen, the Washington official. So, and anybody else on that email train. So you're right. This story can kick around. All right, Tracy, 50 years of the Chicago Reader. And it's been on my mind. Monroe's clapping. Monroe and I are old enough to have been around in the 70s when the Reader first came on the scene. So why don't you talk a little bit about how we're celebrating 50 years of the Reader? Go ahead.
Yeah, we're doing a bunch of different things. The actual 50th anniversary was October 1st. A few days later, the Newberry Library opened an exhibit that includes a lot of ephemera and a timeline about that. It's open through the third week of January, so people can just go down to see it anytime during Newberry normal hours. This month, our two issues in October, including the one out today, have look backs over across time. And today's issue, Mark Jacob did an origin story of the Reader with the four founders, and they actually came into our office a few weeks ago for a photo shoot. So there's a origin story, long, long, long one by Mark Jacob today. I'm sure more people will have input. I've seen on Twitter to various parts of it, history, and a bunch of other different articles in this issue and the issue October 28th that take deep dives into that history. We also are having house parties at various. We've had our first one last week at Lola Wright and Nathan Wright's new landscape business. And we are going to have several more in-person events. Everything about the anniversary can be found at chicagoreader.com/50. Our press release, the house parties, we have merchandise, we had a button design contest with Busy Beaver for a button for each of the five decades. And those are fantastic. So you can do a button pack. We have our Reader 50 mask, find out about the house parties. We also basically think we're going to be celebrating throughout this whole next year. Because of COVID, we didn't want to have one big gala event. So our goal is to end the year next October with some kind of large in-person party, not a sit-down chicken dinner audience for the Reader, but some kind of big celebration. So lots of stuff throughout the next year.
And again, where can people find all the information if they want to participate?
ChicagoReader.com/50. Our merchandise is at ChicagoReader.com/store, STORE. And then we've got lots of other information on the site as well on how people can donate. We're moving to this nonprofit model. We have 501c3 status with the IRS. We just have a few things to finish up with the for-profit before the full transition happens. But we are accepting donations and grants and such to the nonprofit now. So the Reader Institute of Community Journalism is a 501c3. So people can donate at chicagoreader.com/donate.
Tracy, how's the merchandise moving?
It's great. Right when COVID came out, we accelerated a lot of our ideas that we were going to maybe do long term. And we put out an emergency coloring book with 50 artists and split the proceeds. And that raised over $40,000, $20,000 going to the artists. And we did a cookbook. We did best of books, including with Ben Jarafsky, Lior Gulil, Maya Dukmasova, et cetera. And this year, we've tried to slow it down a little because in response to COVID, people were very generous. They knew the emergency was there. But we're doing less merchandise, but trying to do really fun on-brand 50th anniversary stuff. So the buttons, the Reader mask, we just are putting out a map of that John Greenfield had worked on for restaurants in each of the Chicago 77 neighborhoods. So we're going to have that map available soon. But so it does well. We do everything very low risk, so we don't print thousands of anything. We do a limited amount, and then when it sells out, we move on to the next thing. It's really partly a visibility and partly a fundraiser.
Well, that T-shirt you're wearing, folks can't see this. Obviously, I can only hear our podcast, can't see it. But I got a T-shirt like it. It's in California, because I'm a grandfather now, Tracy, as you know. Congrats. And I'm helping my daughter and her husband, and just basically trying to stay out of the way, really, to tell you the truth. But anyway, I was walking on the beach, and I'm wearing my Reader T-shirt, that same black one with the gold. Hey, man, I'm from Chicago. Some guy comes up to me. Yeah, the Reader. Which leads me to this. Monroe and I can reminisce about the Reader from a different perspective than you. We're a little older than you, Tracy. You were a kid growing up in Chicago. in the 70s and in the 80s, Lane Tech graduate. And I know you come from a journalistic background, or at least your parents are journalists. So talk about what the legacy to Reader was for you as a kid growing up in Chicago in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, I was born in 1963, so I was eight when the Reader was founded in 1971. But I was really aware of newspapers as a kid. My mom was at first at she was at a bunch of different community papers in the suburbs and city, and then was at the Tribune when she met my stepfather in the early 60s, early to mid 60s, and then she later was at the Chicago Defender. So newspapers were just in our home, newspapers and magazines. I had a wall of newspaper banners in my closet, like just the titles. I loved fonts. And I just was enamored with the whole business of newspapers. I would make my own family newsletter starting when I was 10. So the Reader was among this hodgepodge of just newspapers, newsprint, and magazines throughout my childhood. I think I first became more aware of it in high school. I was in Lane Tech from 76 to 80. And started to read it and be aware of it. I wasn't really one of the hip, cool kids, so I wasn't trying to get in clubs or anything. I couldn't even pass when I was 30 to get into a bar, so much less at underage. So then when I came back from college in 84, that's when I really started to be aware of how important the Reader was and in the whole ecosystem, what I cared about, progressive politics and even somewhat LGBT stuff back then. They didn't do a lot of gay stuff. But when they did it well and did it from a relatively non-biased perspective compared to the mainstream media. So I've been aware of it probably mostly since 1984.
And, Ben, let me tell you this. I met Tracy when she was a preteen. her father, Steve Pratt, we worked together at the Tribune. And what he'd do every Thanksgiving is invite all the journalists who had to be working on Thanksgiving to Thanksgiving dinner. And so I went to his house, and I think it was 74, I went to their house. It was 74, 75, I'm pretty sure it was 74. And so I've known her since she was a little one.
Even shorter.
Yeah, right, exactly.
12-year-old Tracy Bain. Yeah, I've seen those pictures that Tracy posts from time to time on Facebook. And yes, Tracy, you're absolutely correct. When you were in Lane Tech, you looked like you were about 10. and the same thing for me, though, by the way. When I was at Evanston High School as a kid, man, I looked so young. I was like, so young. Karen Hawkins, who's my editor at The Reader, co-publisher with Tracy, asked me to write a reminiscence about The Reader. So I did a little piece about it that's in this issue as well. And, you know, Tracy, there was a vibe when I first started reading The Reader in the 70s. I would have been just starting college or just still in high, at the end of my distinguished high school career. I picked up on this vibe that the Reader had, and I'd love to get your thoughts and Monroe's thoughts about this as well. And it, to me, it was the Reader in the 70s had this kind of cocky attitude of the alternative paper where it wasn't of the mainstream, so it wasn't going to articulate a mainstream point of view. And it almost as though it was proud of the fact that it was not mainstream, if you get what I'm saying. And so it almost was like, I don't want to say elitist, but it kind of had a put down attitude toward what was considered mainstream news coverage or worldview. And that really impressed me. You get what I'm saying? I just like, yeah, they know these guys are all phonies and hypocrites and they're putting it out there. And I really can pick up on that. And that's driven me so much for my journalistic career from the 80s on that I've been writing for The Reader. That was something I picked up with The Reader. Tracy, I'll start with you. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you think it has that same kind of, were you attracted to that same sensibility in the paper?
Yeah, I mean, I still always felt it was from very much a white lens, a white Chicago lens, looking in at other communities, even if it was from a good politics it was still a pretty one-dimensional perspective. And so I think that's been something that Karen and I have really been aware of, is trying to tilt the lens and expand the lens and have different lenses. So I did enjoy it. I liked it, and certainly appreciated the really terrific journalism and editors and art designers and everything around it. But it did much better on race issues and police brutality and all sorts of things over the decades than the mainstream. But it still felt that it could be that one step further to truly be representative of Chicago, through the writers, the vendors, the way the stories were approached, was mainly from that white lens.
Monroe, your thoughts?
Yeah, and I agree with Tracy 100% about that. I never wrote for the reader. I loved reading it because they did do a lot of interesting stories, I thought, but I never wrote for them. One reason, of course, is that because it was a newspaper, that would have been a no-no with the Tribune management. And, yeah. And because it was a liberal newspaper, it would have been a no from the management. I did freelance for Dollars and Cents, which was this black business publication. I did a couple of pieces in the Chicago magazine, one on Mr. T, one on Reverend Thomas Dorsey. So I did some freelance, but I never did any with the reader. And plus, most of the stories in the reader were so long that I'd have to take a vacation to put the story together.
Okay. Do you know, Tracy, how many times I've heard that in my life? Reader, writer. I can take people saying, Ben, the reader's a North Side paper. Ben, the reader has a white perspective. And by the way, Tracy, to your point, I remember once the reader, it's probably not a memory that's in the 50th anniversary issue, but it ran a cartoon that was just mocking Harold Washington. And this is after he had died, and there was protest. Dorothy Tillman and other activists showed up at the reader, outside the reader office, protesting. I remember this. And then, coincidentally, to your point, Tracy, I was doing a story, a neighborhood news story. I used to do neighborhood news back in the day on the far south side, and a bunch of residents, they were like, let's talk about this. Why should we trust you? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's a great question. And you should ask that question anytime you ever deal with a journalist, not just me. Yeah. Why do you trust anybody?
Yeah.
I think they kind of liked my response. And they go, well, we have no choice, so we're going to have to trust you. But I think I could deal with a lack of trust among black readers more than I could deal with people going, you know, I used to read the reader, Ben, but the stories are so long, I don't read them anymore. And I'm like, what?
No. Right. No, I didn't say I wasn't reading it for the lift. I was saying I didn't want to write it for the lift. Okay. So yeah, I'd had to put in so many hours or something. I mean, you can't make that stuff up in a newspaper. You have to actually interview people.
All right, Tracy Bame. So answer that question. Long form journalism. Do you think there's a place for it in civilization, or are you sympathetic to readers who say, oh, that story is just too long for me? Go ahead, Tracy.
Well, we don't run that kind of length cover story more than probably three or four times a year now. Most stories are well under 5,000 words, many of them under 1,500 words. But those long investigative pieces, Maya Duke-Masova's last one before she left us to go to another outlet, many, many thousands of words. And 4 weeks after it appeared, the person that she wrote about, who'd been in jail for one of several alleged crimes, he had an appeal hearing, and 4 minutes in, those charges were dropped. And there's no way that the deep investigative work that Maya had done didn't feed into that effort. So I do think there's a time for it. I don't think it should be gratuitous or just indulgent to the reporters and editors working on it. I think it there are times when 20,000 words is what is needed, like Maya's investigation into evictions a couple years ago that took 18 months. So I do think long form journalism, like Long Reads promotes online, is necessary. The Atlantic and other publications that do these kind of deep dives. But the vast majority of what we do is not that. We have many little reviews and capsules of music and theater, et cetera. And we have 1,500 word to 5,000 word features. It just depends on what it needs. I don't think we should be artificially cutting or lengthening what a story really needs.
Fair enough. I'm very sympathetic to the long article, Lead It Go. I have a hard time reading them on a phone. I could tell you that right now, Tracy. Reading a really long story on a phone is difficult for me. All right, let's talk a little about the future of journalism in general. You come on this show several times and talked about this. The challenges of trying to keep a paper going through ad revenue in this day and age. You've talked at length about that. Going a nonprofit route, you've talked about that. And we see NPR and the Sun-Times, WBEZ and the Sun-Times making news with a possible merger. Completely caught me off guard. Tracy, I told you that before we went on the air. I did not see that come. Not that anybody would have told me about it in advance, but I didn't see that coming. So what's your sense of that that new possible marriage between the Sun-Times and BEZ? Do you think it could work?
I do think it can work. What I most want to happen is to use this as an opportunity to leverage the great amount of wealth in both foundations that are public and private, that are donor advised, that there's tens of billions of dollars of wealth in this Chicago region, of which probably less than 0.01% of it goes to journalism in any form, either as a donor from individuals or from public and private foundations, donor advised funds, et cetera. So my push on this with anybody who asks is that, great, let's put more coins in the ocean now, because we're about where we can lift the boats with the current capacity of the foundation universe here. We need to find more foundations to do more rather than rely on the typical players that have been trying to prop up local journalism on their own. We have to add to the universe. So the people that donate to BEZ and have funded the Chicago Sun-Times, I believe, need to be pressured to see this universe around them. I don't think they're antagonistic towards it. I think many of them are just ignorant to it in terms of there being dozens. We have 69 members of the Chicago Independent Media Alliance that the Reader launched a couple years ago. That's only partial to all the other community media that exists. And it won't take much to save community media compared to the lift that it's going to take to save the Sun-Times. So I think this is an opportunity to say, okay, great. You do that, but you do that in kind of concert with the rest of community media, and we can lift everybody by putting more coins in the ocean. And so that's what my advocacy is going to be on this whole topic. We've been pushing at the Reader for a journalism pooled fund in Chicago to be hosted at a foundation where many family and other foundations can put money into a pooled fund so that that money can be filtered into community media by the experts, as opposed to every family foundation having a journalism program officer. So that's I've been advocating that for a couple of years now. This is an opportunity to do it. So we're meeting with funders and foundations and all sorts of people saying, let's take advantage right now of this window when people understand the role of journalism and democracy and bring more resources to the table to help BEZ, the Sun-Times, and the whole rest of community media. We do not want to lose the Black press, the Latino press, the Polish press, the Korean press, the Reader, everything else in saving the Sun-Times. We need to save both, all of them.
Monroe, do you think there's room for all these different presses in Chicago?
There once was, although online media has changed the game completely. I mean, why pay for the milk when you can get the cow for free? That's the problem with this is. Young people in particular have been conditioned to get their media just by going online, and that's it. And going back to the Reader for a minute, I personally attributed the Reader for the development of Chicago's vast theater community, because they used to run that section where you could find out where plays and what have you going. And so if you had a storefront and some friends who did theater, you could literally launch a theater. And sometimes, like if it was, say, the Steppenwolf, it would grow into something really important. But even I mean, at one time there were 200 theaters in Chicago, of the Chicago area, of one type or another. And I particularly think the Reader did that just single-handedly.
Yeah, that's part of the Reader's legacy that I didn't participate in. I must tell both of you, I don't think I've ever written a theater or a rock and roll story for the Reader. And back in the day, Tracy, that's the other thing. The music section in the Reader was so powerful, so right. important, so significant, right. at least on the North side. And it was just a powerful voice in it. I never participated in that. Tracy, I got to ask you about Facebook and its impact. And I haven't picked your brain on this one. Since the Facebook scandal has erupted, since the whistleblower went on 60 Minutes, I'm utterly obsessed with Frances Haugen and that her story and what she had to say and what she revealed about the Facebook model and how Facebook figured out that they could make a fortune by just giving people whatever information the people wanted that their computers picked up, detected, that people would click on this. And so they just kept feeding it to them and feeding it to them and feeding to them. So what's the impact of this sort of algorithm model that Facebook has made such a fortune off on journalism today?
Well, the impact of especially Google and Facebook and Instagram on the advertising model is what we most profoundly see every day. I mean, more than 80%, if not more, of most of advertising budgets in this country go to online digital mega sites like Facebook and Google. And so the shift in advertising dollars has had the most negative effect on media. In terms of kind of curation of the news, I think it calls out the need for those editorial gatekeepers, but better gatekeepers, right? The gatekeepers of the past were mostly straight, cisgender white men who kept out a lot of other kinds of stories. So gatekeepers inherently can have biases and problems, including those that are created by machines. Machines are programmed by people. There's always gonna be bias, right? But when you have this incredible algorithm power of Facebook, Google, and others, Instagram targeting teen girls with image issues, and it's horrendous, right? It's like as if we put alcohol instead of water in our pipes. It's like nobody's regulating them. It's going everywhere and it's poisoning people. Those who can self-regulate and self-curate and only take a sip of it, great, all power to you. But the vast majority of people that are vulnerable are being taken advantage of by these algorithms, And so it is something that needs watching. It needs regulating. I hope the cat's not fully out of the bag on this. I'm not sure. And I saw something where, only 13% of their money watching these problems is spent outside of the United States. So they are watching it here better, which is relative, but that the amount of misinformation influencing other countries is not really being watched in other languages. They're not doing a good job of that. So we're toppling governments through Facebook. They're toppling, all sorts of democracy around the world. I don't know if they can fix it, right? Because we're just the U.S. It comes from everywhere, all of the problems. And yet WhatsApp and other things are like utilities for so many millions of people around the world. So it's a real difficult solution, and Congress is late to the table. I'm not sure if they can do much about this worldwide problem.
Well, Monroe and I talk about the political ramifications of this. And we're probably going to be heading into a national political conversation. We'll let you go from there, Tracy. I don't want to have to burden you with getting into the ins and the outs of national politics. But I will ask you about this. Monroe and I talk a lot about the different critiques that the right and the left have about Facebook and social media in general. And so much of what MAGA complains about Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, I don't buy at all. But they treat it as though there's this, you talk about a gatekeeper, that the gatekeeper is our liberals or lefties who are preventing MAGA from getting their views out. And so that they're the victims. They play the victim card, which it boggles my mind that they actually get away with it. They believe it. And so that's their critique.
Well, but if you look at what the right wing media is doing, and all those millions of people that live in that bubble, then anything outside of that is not right, because they're lying to their people. The Foxes and the QAnon and Rush when he was alive. I mean, they were giving them a constant stream of lies, and that was their reality. So when they're presented with the real reality, that doesn't make any sense to them whatsoever. That's not, that couldn't possibly be true, because they didn't hear it on Fox.
Yeah. Well, that's to my point. Like, I don't know how you can quote unquote reform this process if the right and the left, their Democrats and Republicans, are coming in from two different vantage points. So on one hand, my view as a lefty or a liberal, whatever, is that you have to clean it up so that they're not presenting obvious falsehoods. MAGA's point of view is you have to let go of all filters, otherwise it's censorship. And so when I look at those contrasting viewpoints of what the is expected of government in regards to regulating Facebook, Tracy Monroe, it's like so many other issues today. I don't see a convergence that would satisfy either side or both sides. Tracy, your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, it feels quaint to think of crying fire in a theater, yelling fire in a theater, right? Like the mass of this universe now that they occupy is almost unregulatable. And I don't know, you know, anybody's intent. You can't know anybody's intent. I know people that work at Facebook that tried to stop this funnel of hate, but it is a mixed bag, because if they get considered a public utility, it almost might be worse, because then the right wing will say that it, you know, it needs to be an open funnel of hell of communication. So, it's way above my pay grade to figure out how this gets solved. But I do think there has to be some responsibility. As publishers, we're responsible for content that gets out there. And we have to have libel lawyers and all that kind of stuff. We have regulation of ourselves through the law, right? It's not like we're regulated in the courts, but we could be if we do something that crosses a line. And these Facebook and others don't seem to have any, there seems to be no responsibility that we can hold them to.
All right, Tracy, we're going to let you go because Monroe and I are feeling the urge to have a national political conversation. One last time, okay. Just tell folks, give it that the information they want to, more information about the Reader's 50th anniversary, upcoming events, etc.
ChicagoReader.com/50, ChicagoReader.com/store, or ChicagoReader.com/donate. Thanks, everybody.
Take care, Tracy. Bye, Tracy Bain, co-publisher of the Chicago Reader. All right, Monroe, before we head out the door, let's get a little political talk in, and we'll talk about January 6th. That was the insurrection. I watched it with you. I watched it on your face. I love telling people the story that we were on the air live, and you had your TV on, and the look, you're like, I urge folks, by the way, go check out that. That's a pretty funny thing. Monroe, oh, my God. You wouldn't believe what's going on. I was right.
That's when they were climbing the walls.
Yeah.
And breaking the windows.
So here we are. Monroe, how many months later? It's, oh my goodness, it's 9 months later.
Yes.
Almost 10 months later. Right. MAGA has totally changed the storyline. And now the storyline is that Democrats are picking on them,
right?
Basically.
Right.
MAGA's doing what it does best, crying, playing the victim card, which is so funny because all they do is talk about how liberals are snowflakes.
Yes.
And the biggest snowflakes in America, as far as I could tell, are MAGA.
Right.
Because every time you even criticize them, they start talking about censorship and, you know, and they're picked on for their beliefs, et cetera, and so forth. Now they've turned it into this crusade, a political crusade, where they won't abide by congressional subpoenas. Stephen Bannon, of all people, is advising the former aide, top aide, you know, political aide to Donald Trump, is advising Donald Trump's former employees, don't turn over your documents to congressional investigators. How far do you think they're going to push this, Monroe?
I think they're going to push it until they go to jail. And then they'll find Jesus at that point. But I think they're going to jail. I think the House Democrats, with their committee and with Ms. Cheney backing them up, are going to be tough as nails. This is going to be one instance where Democrats act like Republicans. And they're going to take names and collect dues. And that will be a good thing, because when Trump was in office, they could ignore the subpoenas because it would go to Barr's DOJ. And Barr would look at it and say, Ho, isn't this funny? And it's Charleston in file 13. The Democrats are going to be very serious about this. They're going to make criminal charges because crimes were committed.
So you think they're Bannon just got out of quote unquote jail.
Well, Trump gave him a get out of jail free card.
Unbelievable.
But Trump can't do it anymore. Trump is worried about his own get out of jail free card.
But Monroe, it's the gall of Steve Bannon is just amazing. He got caught in some scam.
Right.
He was allegedly abusing money that was donated for various Republican causes. He got caught in that. Trump let him go. You're right. Commuted a sentence or whatever before he could actually get thrown in jail. Now he's right back at it.
Right. And this time he's not going to be able to wiggle his way out. Yeah. Although he's
so your trying. Sense of it after 9 months later, do you think the Republicans have been successful at flip-flopping what went down January 6th, or are they merely playing to a core, their small group?
They flip-flopped it among their crowd, their mob. Because if you remember, when the insurrection was happening, the MAGA crowd was saying, those that weren't there wearing the Trump t-shirts and MAGA stuff, but the audience who was watching it said that this was Black Lives Matter and Antifa posing as MAGA people to give the MAGAs. And that didn't last very long because, you know, we got the pictures and the movies, so you couldn't continue with that. So now what they're doing is saying, well, it was that one day, or it really wasn't that big a deal. It was a few protesters that got out of hand. So they're trying to change the story to that. Well, except I think it's 25% of Republicans justify the violence because we were stealing the election from Trump. And so it was by any means necessary.
Which is 25%. Damn, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
And that's 25% controls the Republican Party. So that's where they're at right now. That 25% controls the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And that's the real hardcore. And then it could be like a John Gruden types who believe it, but don't say it publicly.
Right. Oh, there are a lot of those. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what we have to do is just be on the warpath, not physically, but media, just keep repeating the truth to beat down the big lie. We just have to stay at it. And we have got to hold those responsible who are responsible.
All right. We'll switch to Joe Biden, get a Joe Biden update before we head out the door. And it's been very difficult for me to take, Monroe, the vacillation, the Democrats sort of incapable of sticking to one package or another when it comes to infrastructure, when it comes to the social agenda, the pressure on them because of Manchin and Sinema is forcing them to whittle away at their programs. They still haven't passed anything. They're unsure if they're willing
The Democrats have made the mistake that the Democrats keep doing, is they let the Republicans name the game. And so the Republicans are talking about money and making it sound like it's a big deal, what have you. And the Democrats have been arguing with them about whether that was enough money or too much money, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of every Democrat in office in D.C. and everybody in all the states should be talking about what you would be getting if this bill goes through, this human infrastructure bill goes through. They should be naming, different people should be naming different prospects of it, aspects of it. But that should be the story, not how much money it's going to cost or anything like that, but just how good it's going to be for you, for America. And they should just be naming it and going into great detail on what will be in there. Of course, part of the problem is it hasn't been written completely. This is an outline with everybody wishing what they want because they've been fighting over the money.
Yeah.
And it's crazy.
Well, I don't see right now, things can change, but I don't see right now that unity that is necessary to do what you said. I just don't see it. And it seems like Kristen Sinema, her behavior is more and more bizarre all the time. And I had this conversation with David Ferris last week. It's just kind of obvious to me that she really is a Republican.
Or she got bought off, I think.
She what?
She got bought off. Because she had one position for the longest. And then one day, oh, my God, I have seen the light. It should be this other position. What was that, on climate change, I think?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And I wanted to say this, that the people who say she's like John McCain are really missing the point. John McCain, by and large, was a right-wing Republican. And I watched John McCain's career from the get-go. And I liked aspects of his personality that I liked. You know, he had a sense of humor. I appreciated that. But essentially, he was a right-wing Republican.
Right.
Monroe. And so if she was the equivalent of John McCain, she would be a Bernie Sanders Democrat.
Yeah.
That's the equivalent. She would be on the left of the Democratic Party.
Right.
Or at the very least, she would be your basic bread and butter Richard Durbin Democrat.
Right. Now she's trying to be McCain in a skirt.
She's trying to be a Republican McCain. Yes. She's trying.
Well, not McCain was a Republican.
Yeah.
Right.
She's not John McCain of the Democrats. Yeah. She's John McCain.
Yeah, right. Exactly. No, she's trying to be John McCain in a skirt. He was a Republican.
And Republican.
Right.
In Monroe.
But she has seized upon the whole maverick identity.
But that's the part that shakes my head.
Right.
John McCain was a maverick, quote, on things like campaign finance reform. One aspect of a whole. He was for tax breaks for the wealthy. He was against expanding health care. He was for more military, way more military spending. You know, he was like for charter schools. He was Republican.
Right. And the only reason he voted for Obamacare was he gave the thumbs down to the Republicans because he was giving the finger up to Trump.
Personally. Yeah. You know? He saved, for what it's worth, he saved the Republican Party almost, you know, because it would have been political suicide to take away Obamacare at that point in time.
Yeah.
And so the Republicans got the best of both worlds with that one, Monroe. And you and I have talked about this.
Yeah.
They got to pound their chest against Obamacare. So their base get fired up because the base hates anything related to Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Which is really twist. It goes back to John Gruden. God, I wonder what John Gruden had to say about Barack Obama.
It goes back to racism. That's what it goes back to. I mean, that's where they are. And because if you notice, they aren't talking about Obamacare anymore. That's not one of their issues. Now they're talking about the border and all these not white people getting in. And what is their other
critical issue? Race theory?
Critical race theory, yes. So they that Trump actually won the election and Biden is not really the president.
Yeah,
those are their three issues.
Yeah, you're right. They forgot it because they know that Obamacare is they're trying to undo Obamacare is a losing.
Right.
Proposition because you give people something, they want it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? They don't want it.
Right. Exactly. It's hard to take something that was good for you or people away from them. And the thing with the infrastructure, the reason they want to stick with the money, the Republicans, because if you go into detail on what you get with the human infrastructure law, then they would lose. Most Republicans like what's in the package individually and collectively, but they're being told that it's gonna make their children poor and turn America into a communist country and other run of the mill Republican lies.
All right, we'll close with a Biden update. The Washington Post, I now read the Washington Post on a regular basis. I have to admit it's pretty entertaining.
Yeah.
Is really been pounding this drum for a while. Joe Biden is in trouble. The polls are really, really bad. And Monroe Anderson has a different take on that, on the polls and Joe Biden. So, Monroe, close with your theories, your viewpoint on the current public opinion polls.
The current opinion poll, singular, Quinnipiac, it was an outlier, and it had Biden's approval rating at 38. The rest of the polls have him in the high 40s. He's less than he was, but he's still much greater than, greater than Trump ever got. So, and the main, Biden has not had a good month. People liked him because they thought that he had a handle on COVID. And then you got the outbreaks in the southern states because a whole bunch of ignoramuses won't get the vaccine. And so they're dying, you know, they'd rather die than get the vaccine, and that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Then the withdrawal from Afghanistan didn't help. Although, if you look at it objectively, it was a very successful withdrawal, but it didn't look pretty. It looked bad on TV. And then you have inflation. Rearing its ugly head because the supply chain is busted. For example, with a lot of the goods that we're not getting and the prices are going up on, we don't have trucks. You have these ships from Asia and places like that with all kind of goodies on them, but we don't have enough truckers to distribute the goods throughout the nation.
So your basic take is that it's not as dismal as the Washington Post makes it seem, and we're pretty much where we were 6 months ago. We're like in a stall period.
The COVID is going down. You have the booster shot coming. 5 to 12 year olds are going to be getting their vaccinations. So COVID will be pretty much under control, unless you get a new variant, and who knows about that. Although theoretically, at least so far, the vaccines take care of all variants right now.
Well, I'll close with this line that D.L. Hewley just posted on Instagram. It's pretty funny. Vaccine mandates are causing teachers who don't believe in science to quit, nurses who don't believe in medicine to quit, and cops who don't believe in public safety to quit. I'm failing to see the downside to this.
he can't be funny.
Yeah, and man is funny, man. D.L. Hewley's been getting me through this stuff. And he loves Dave Chappelle, ladies and gentlemen. D.L. Hewley loves Dave Chappelle. We'll keep that topic for another time. Monroe Anderson, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. Appreciate it as always. And if I get, I'll just tell you this, if I can hook up with Bennett Johnson, we're going to have one hell of a show next week, Monroe. I'll be back in Chicago and Bennett will be on with us. We'll be talking about all kinds of things Muhammad Ali related. All right, Monroe, thank you very much. I also want to thank Tracy Baim, publisher of the Chicago Reader, for talking about the 50th anniversary of the Chicago Reader and other media news. And, of course, the man, the myth, the legend, the pride and joy of all Illinois, without whom the show be possible. And as Monroe and Tracy will tell you, back home in Alton, they call him White Lightning. Give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. See you tomorrow, everybody.
I've seen a whole lot of catfish and turtles. No gators yet, though.